I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, Australia. But are you in Australia, Martin, or are you in Lyon or Paris, perhaps Berlin? Or tell me, you're in Sydney today.
I'm in the beautiful town of Broome, and what a good time to be in Broome in late July. It's lovely up here, Michael.
Well, and I'm sure everybody on the streets of Broome are talking democracy, Martin. I mean, democracy with a capital D or a little D, a big Y, no Y at all, democ-rack. It's on everyone's lips, Martin. Have you been following the ICAC, the famous or the infamous ICAC, depending on your viewpoint, who've been looking into kiddies, trying to control the Liberal Party in New South Wales, Martin, giving evidence about their exploits?
Yes, these exploits at ICAC are very fascinating, and they remind us the importance of anti-corruption organisations, because it's not clear that they were successful, but there was an attempt here to really use money to buy influence in the Liberal Party, essentially. Angus Taylor has been mentioned in dispatches, but it's not clear that he's done anything wrong, just to be fair and to be clear. But this is a sort of a small group within the Liberal Party that is seeking to make illicit donations and then thereby gain influence.
It is fascinating, isn't it? There's been all of these headlines about dirt files. Apparently, they call them shit files if you're an aficionado in the know in whatever party. And if someone gets too high and mighty and they're not in your faction and they once smiled at a pretty girl, you bring out the photo, Martin, and you show them up. I mean, is this what politics is really all about?
There's always been some of that in politics, unfortunately. People keep the receipts, so to speak, and it's a messy business, and people often seek to undermine you accordingly.
Well, Martin, I got a surprise this morning. One of the big headline stories is that the Governor General, Sam Marston, has been warning of a quote unquote growing catastrophe that threatens to undermine democracy in Australia. I mean, there are some people who think she's running the country. Is she? Perhaps better give our listeners a quick tutorial in Australian democracy.
I think this is interesting because technically the head of state is the king of the UK that's represented by the Governor General. But actually, real executive power lies with the Prime Minister and his cabinet, who are members of Parliament. Now, those people that don't understand a lot about democracy and don't understand a lot about how it might work might get that confused. And that's part of her point, I believe, is that people don't know and understand enough about democracy, and therefore they jump to all these wild conclusions, including asking her to take over the show and asking her to implement this, that, and the other. So I think that was a really fascinating observation by the Governor General.
It wouldn't surprise me in this modern world that we live in, where bits and pieces of news or fake news circulate the globe in moments, that people would think that the Governor General of Australia is as powerful as Donald Trump thinks he is as President of the United States. And so you get this sort of complaint, and I quote it from the Governor General here. It's mostly people who attack our system who say we shouldn't have a Governor General, or who ask the Governor General to do things that are not within my powers, or criticise me for signing the bills that I must sign, because they think I should have a view that clearly I do not have as Governor General. Certain things I must do under my constitutional requirements. I mean, she's not even elected.
That's inherently the point. She's appointed technically by the King on the advice of the Prime Minister, but it's our elected officials that are charged with running the country. And convention, which is the traditions that dictate how our democracies run, are very important in Australia. But you need to understand our system to understand that. And I think there is a growing gap in between the public and our politicians, and where the public don't understand or appreciate what Parliament's role is and what the government's role is and who's really responsible for what.
Well, you'd have to sort of say we forgive you, the public, if you feel or are confused in that way, because we just had a change of premier in Victoria, Martin. Suddenly you've got a premier, Jacinda Allan, and then suddenly you've got a new premier, Ben Carroll, and it all happens out in some back room or little huddled meetings over a Sunday night, and suddenly there's a new guy in the job who wasn't elected premier after all, was he?
This is a good point, Michael, and a fair enough one. People at the last election saw Daniel Andrews, no less, run for office, and he was elected. And they've got now had him resign and Jacinda Allan take over, and then Jacinda Allan forced out by Ben Carroll. So voters are entitled to think what's really going on here. And it's not that long ago we had the Rudd-Gillard Rudd, and then we had Abbott Turnbull Morrison, which we'll remember, where people who were elected prime ministers were turfed out by their own party before they ever saw the next election. So those kind of activities do really confuse people and lead to a sense of disenchantment.
Well, Martin, all the political pundits, of course, I don't include myself in that, but I include you in that group, are all going into overdrive about, does it make any difference in political terms if the new guy comes in and the old one goes out? Because it seems, and we discussed this just a week ago, we were well ahead of the game, that the Allan Victorian Labor government was on the nose. Will it be any less on the nose, do you think? Are the polls telling us anything yet, now that they've got Carroll in
We've
charge?
not seen when it's too early. It literally happened at the start of this week. I think that over the next week or two, we might get a bit of a picture unfolding about whether that change in Premier in Victoria does make a difference. The new Premier's come out and already set some new policy directions. Most notably, he's having a Royal Commission into building sites in Victoria where there's a lot of allegations of corruption. So he's getting to the bottom of that. That was something that his predecessor refused to do. There's some indication that he might change some of the industrial legislation that had been pursued previously. So he needs to make some policy U-turns and make a splash because he's got very little time, Michael. He's got 4 months until the election. So I think that that's a really high bar, and I'm not sure he can meet it. But he
Well,
might be saving the furniture.
Martin, I vividly recall, because I then got caught up in it, that Carmen Lawrence, as Premier of Western Australia in late 1990, called a Royal Commission into all the allegations, principally concerning the prior Burke Labor government, which had turned Labor's political fortunes deep south or north. I'm not sure which direction is bad. I think south. And it didn't save that government, and I suspect that'll be the real concern, is the real concern of the Labor Party in Victoria. They put a new man in, hope that he's got a new bouffant hairstyle, Martin. That'll attract a lot of people to the party, surely.
Well, I did note that myself, and not that we are superficial here on the view from the roundhouse, but he was very immaculately dressed as well, Michael. So he's turning up very, very professional. But he's also, I think the other pro he does have a bit of a problem. He appears to be a candidate from central casting. I don't know that he's, every time he speaks, professionally, but it doesn't really engender excitement, charisma, those sorts of things. Maybe that's why he's deputy and not the main guy.
Well, I have seen him on the television. He's following a careful script in front of him. He hasn't taken his eye off it. He doesn't want to put one word out of place, or he knows what will happen. He'll be mercilessly skewered in the media and everywhere else. But he coming from central casting these days means you need to have been tied up somehow with the famous shoppies union, Martin, the SDA, Peter Malinauskas, Don Farrell. There's a lot of them in Queensland and here now in Victoria. They're a pretty powerful union.
They're one of the largest unions in the right, in the Labor Party, I should say the right faction. For uninitiated viewers, there's a lot of factions in the Labor Party, and the right faction is they're a stalwart within that grouping. But there's a lot of fluidity in factional politics in Labor these days. It's not as set as it used to be, and there's been splits in the Victorian right in Victoria. I think that the factions got together actually to initiate this change because they were on the brink of disaster and they realised they needed to desperately do something. So the deputy was seen as the safe pair of hands, basically.
Well, not only does Ben Carroll have a, as I say, a boofy hairstyle, he's very, very neatly dressed, but I have to say, nowhere near as well dressed or as colourfully dressed as Pauline Hanson when she was in Sicily at the big Dolce & Gabbana sort of catwalk show with Gina Rinehart recently, Martin. And now it's come out, she's amended or added to her disclosures in the Parliament. Trip, I think, was funded by Gina, wasn't it?
Substantial parts of it were. I think there were some parts that were self-funded, but certainly substantial parts of the Italian trip were. And I think this does, raise all those questions about party donations and about gifts and the like. I should say Pauline is by no means on her own in this respect. There are lots of questions about our leading politicians, Pauline and Gina, but there's also Anthony Albanese and a dinner that he attended with a Chinese businessman who has been caught up in major tax matters. So lots of questions about what he knew about that as well. So it does raise that point about party donations, the influence of donors, and the importance of transparency.
I suppose the money in politics laws, the donations disclosure laws, in a timely fashion, if they are in a timely fashion, all help democracy to work. You can see that a particularly large donor has flown you in for a birthday party or taken you to Sicily for a holiday, or sorry, for political dialogue, and you can say, what's going on here? Are they being run by that person? That it's Kim Philby being run by the KGB, surely. I mean, if Anthony Albanese had been flown in to Sicily for a midterm break at the expense of Gina Rinehart, what would people be saying?
I think that it's good that we've got that transparency so that we do know and we know pretty quickly about this. So that declaration allows people to ask those questions. And note that that declaration came after Pauline wasn't especially keen to talk about who funded that trip. So, but our disclosure laws make our politicians at least open up about these things and then we can ask further questions.
Well, let's just come to sort of further example of all of that. Just remind us all that we've got the Secret Harbour by-election happening here just south of Fremantle before long. People have been stopping me in the street, Martin, asking me as if I'd know who's going to win it. But I saw Michaelia Cash, the senior Liberal from Western Australia, in the Senate making some most unusual comments. I thought she'd hoisted up the white flag and was saying that they're going to support One Nation to win. Have I got that wrong?
There seemed to be that indication, and there's also even a comment by Basil. Now Basil's mostly said, "Oh well, our man's in the box seat to win, and he can do this, and don't write us off, and all that sort of stuff." But he also said it's not our role to shield Labor from One Nation, Labor from the ramifications. So he's also kind of said when he's asked about preferencing that. It's not his job to stand in the road of a One Nation victory if it comes to that. So there's hints there, even from him, that One Nation's got a good chance here.
Well, we're going to see what are going to be the indicators whether there's a real battle on our hands when it comes to Secret Harbour with the One Nation candidate.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Firstly, we're already seeing Labor go very hard against One Nation in the socials, more so than the Liberal Party. And that will tell you. It's that old adage in politics, Michael, don't listen to what they say, listen to what they do. And if you look at the posts by Labor relating to Secret WA Labor, they're mostly focusing on One Nation at the moment. And what threat to democracy they are, and how disastrous they would be, et cetera, et cetera. That tells us what we need to know. I think that they see One Nation as the main threat, and I think they're worried, and that's why they're putting that effort in.
Well, This is quoting from the Financial Review story just a couple of days ago, where they report that Michaela Cash on Tuesday defended her party's move to preference One Nation over Labor in the by-election for Secret Harbour. And I quote, "We made a very conscious decision to preference someone who's from the centre-right. We are prepared to work with people on the centre-right," Cash said in reference to One Nation as a, at a business breakfast in Perth. And speaking to reporters outside the event, she said, "Some One Nation policies were not so different from those of the Liberals." And I quote, "You have to look at One Nation's policies, and they very much are smaller government, less intervention, which is consistent with the Liberal Party's policies." So, I mean, she's getting ready, isn't she, for the Libs not doing well there and prepared to take Labor down by any measure.
It is quite interesting because they are competing for the same space. So I would have thought at some stage the Liberal Party really does need to take on One Nation and protect its turf. And there's been a little bit of that. Angus Taylor made a speech a few weeks ago attacking Pauline Hanson more directly. But there's been a range of other Liberal Party people that have kind of suggested they're one and the same. I don't think they are. I think there is significant differences between them. And I think it would behove the Liberals to actually accentuate these differences better and try to frame themselves as the realistic, responsible alternative to Labor. That's the strategy I take, but I'm not quite sure we're seeing that.
Well, just pivoting slightly in politics, and it's not just the federal government, it's the state government in South Australia and Western Australia as well, who are all motivated by doing better than anybody else when it comes to defence strategies, particularly building nuclear-powered submarines, Martin. Fremantle Shipping News published an article just 2 days ago, which we headed AUKUS, full steam ahead, reporting on what Pat Conroy, the Minister for Defence Industry, who's been in Washington DC and roundabout, had to say. I mean, he was making it clear they thought that the Americans were still going to build these vessels and sell them to us, and that we'd be building ours for sure, that we're sending Australian steel to the US so that'll go into the hulls of these things, that people are being trained at great rate of knots, and that here the Henderson Defence Precinct, literally a couple of good covered drives down the road from here, Martin, is going ahead full steam. I mean, this is the Labor Party. This is more the right or centre of the Labor Party, isn't it? It's probably Dan Carroll would love to have all of this going on in Melbourne. So, but what do we make of it?
Well, I think that this is what this is. Both these two governments, WA and South Australia, it's a very hard sell on the economic benefits and particularly the benefits to jobs of these AUKUS projects. And amidst all of the other concerns about relations with the US and Trump says this and Trump says that, they realise that on the ground they need to sell the benefits of this in particular. So that's why you see both the governments kind of, there's a bit of a mirror to how they're approaching this. There's a lot of similarities, trying to pitch the local get benefits. Of course, we're in the middle at the moment here in Western Australia of that Secret Harbour by-election, which is not that far away from the main bases that and the main areas where we're talking about for activity. So it probably makes extra sense.
Well, what I don't understand, Martin, and you might be able to help me, there seems there's going to be an old-fashioned national cabinet meeting chaired by the PM, Anthony Albanese, soon, all about the fuel excise. People talk about the fuel excise. It looks like it's going to be ended.
It will be, and I think Jim Chalmers reinforced that again today. There'd been some discussion about extending it, but the government was never that keen on doing it because it saw these, it saw that cut. It's very much a temporary measure only. It doesn't see that as sustainable in the long run. Even the opposition's not that keen on extending it. They've talked about other potential measures, but the problem is this conflict's setting in. It's not a temporary spike anymore in price. This is a longer term measure. So the revenue implications of the government in extending this are growing by the day. So I think this time they bit the bullet and they said there's not much more we can do. We'll try and do some other things instead. And that excise is going back up to its normal range.
So that means that the money will be pouring into the national coffers.
Well, that's right. Well, fuel excess is a major source of revenue for the Commonwealth government. And GST-wise, it's an important source of revenue also for state and territory governments.
Well, you don't get to build roads at any cheap rate, and it's a lot of Commonwealth money that usually goes in. If you're driving south from Perth and there's some change to the Kwinana Freeway near Fremantle, as they're going to be starting on next week, you'll see all the big signs funded by Anthony Albanese and a few bottle tops thrown in by Roger Cook.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing. That's the bigger picture to remember that these these ex-fellas do fund our roads. It's not technically tied to one, but one thing to the other. But it has been the major source of revenue.
Martin, you can't help but think, we haven't been talking about it, I just haven't been able to bring myself to ask you any questions about it, the Middle East war. It looks like it's becoming much more a Middle East war at the moment. Somebody dropped something in Egypt, you've got things hitting Jordan, you've got the Houthis still misbehaving, if you can put it that way, down further. You've got Iran quite happy to keep lobbing bombs wherever they can. And Trump threatens, but as usual, as you keep telling me, don't look at what he says, look at what he does. And he hasn't actually done a lot, it seems to me, except that he reckons this morning that the Board of Peace has reached agreement for disarming Hamas in Gaza. Can you believe it? Are these things
Well,
tied?
there is a lot to unpack there. We'll just race through a couple of things briefly. The Middle East, even in a week, a hell of a lot happening in one time. So Iran has continued to attack a number of other sites. Of course, the US has been attacking Iran quite regularly. There was something unusual in that we had a preemptive strike by Iran on US bases, which has enraged Trump, but it shouldn't really because I mean there's been ongoing fighting. We've got the Houthis on the other side of the Saudi Gulf that have started threatening shipping on that side, which will further choke commercial carriage, including goods. And then the latest thing, probably a glimmer of hope, but who knows whether we can really trust it, and that's that Hamas might be disarming to further the peace process in Gaza. I'm a bit skeptical of this until we get confirmation from Hamas themselves that they wish to do this, and they haven't said anything yet. So I guess we'll wait and see. Look, I think that would be a positive step, but I think that there's a lot of still a long way to run in terms of finding proper peace in Gaza. So that's a really quick whip around, Michael. I don't think I've even got to Zelensky and Netanyahu in the White House, have I?
No, and I wanted to ask you because it seems to me that President Trump's once again holding up very shiny things that are glinting in the light, and they've got sort of Gaza over them. We're solving problems there to take everyone's attention off everything else. And at the same time, Lindsey Graham passed away recently, a hawkish senator who was a mate, it seems, of both Bibi Netanyahu and Zelensky, and supported each of their regimes in military terms. They all turn up in Washington for the funeral, and they go and have chats with Trumpy. How do they do?
Well, the fascinating thing is, if you go back a little while, Netanyahu and Trump were close, very close, like best buddies. And Zelensky and Trump had a very frosty relationship, including Trump actually belittling him in the White House in front of all the press, which was very nasty. But there's a couple of things have happened. Netanyahu keeps on pushing Trump to do his dirty work for him and attacking Iran, etc. And that has not turned out well at all for Trump in the US. And so he's a bit cynical about what he gets told from Netanyahu now. On the other hand, Zelensky's shown the durability of him and his forces in holding Russia at bay, including attacking Russia, no less, on its own turf with drones, and perhaps even lending logistical or other support for the war against Iran. So all of a sudden, Zelensky is a bit more the flavor of the month now. So the tables are really turned here.
Well, Trump's previously called him a sort of a second-rate comedian. Perhaps he'll up his rating and say that he is nearly as good as Jason Sudeikis, Ted Lasso. We'll see. Martin, thanks for joining me today. And just one word of warning, don't get sunburned up there in Broome, and make sure you're watching the television tonight when Fremantle Dockers take on the Western Bulldogs. And if they win, we'll secure the minor premiership for 2026 in the AFL men's.
Big match coming up.
See you next week, Martin.
Pleasure as always, Michael.